in the lair of the lust. At that moment, 2,800 miles away, the bright boy who thought it up, Charlie Croker, layer offer of freezer pickers, woke up with a start. His eyes popped open like a pair of umbrellas. He couldn't see a damn thing, it was so dark in here. The neck of his nightshirt was wet with perspiration. The big rabbit, his heart, was thumping away in his chest. The Wiz's latest numbers were already churning through his head, and he hadn't been awake 5 seconds. It was bad enough having Planner's Bank checking in practically every day with new demands, new threats, to seize this, attach that, encumber the other thing. But this afternoon the Wiz has to come hustling into his office to inform him of some horror the IRS has dreamed up called phantom gains. Phantom gains! The bank forecloses, you lose your shirt, and the IRS hits you with a whole ton of taxes for your phantom gains. And now, as he lies here in bed in the dark, his heart starts thumping in a funny way, as if fluttering to the rhythm of the words themselves. Phantom gains. Phantom gains. And then, galumph, a palpitation, twang. It snaps back to its regular beat. The Insomnia Factory was open for the day, heading toward peak production. He looked at the clock by the bed. Its feverish little green digits said 3:20. He turned toward Serena. There was barely enough ambient light to make out her silhouette. She was lying on her side, turned away from him. He could see one of her haunches welling up beneath the covers. It was a wonder he could see that much. Must be thanks to the tiny light from the clock. Sure as hell couldn't be from the windows. He stared toward them, three tall windows overlooking the rolling, big-breasted lawns of Buckhead. But he couldn't even locate them in the dark. Not a glimmer of light seeped through. Serena had had Ronald Vine load them down with enough fabric, enough shades, enough under-curtains, inner curtains, outer curtains, whatever it all was, to smother an army. "You must be crazy, Croker." He had let her sink more than $3.5 million into the interior of this house. $3.5 million he'd like to get his hands on right now. And just try. He had paid $2,750,000 for the property itself, which had been a huge price for Atlanta, even for the Buckhead area in the final swell of the last real estate bubble, which was when he had bought it. He had already sunk a fortune into one extravaganza in Buckhead, over on Valley Road, which had gone to Martha in the divorce. So now he had bought a second one, barely a half mile away, here on Blackland Road. Irritably, Charlie propped himself up on one elbow, halfway hoping the deflection of the mattress would wake Serena. Not a chance. Her slumbering young loins and lamb chops rose and fell. She was breathing regularly in the blissful sleep of youth. He felt a stab of nostalgia for Martha. Or not for Martha herself, exactly, but for life with Martha. Martha, he could have reached over to and shaken by the shoulder, and she would have put up with it and woken up and asked him why he couldn't sleep. Your first wife married you for better or for worse. Your second wife, particularly if you were 60 and she was a 28-year-old number like Serena, why kid yourself? She married you for better. Charlie could suddenly see the prissy face of Martha's daddy, Dr. Bunting Starling, president back then of the Commonwealth Club in Richmond, Virginia, where he had hosted the wedding reception. Charlie's own daddy, Mr. Earl Croker, lately of a hole in the ground in Baker County, Georgia, had gotten so drunk at that reception he had jumped on the bandstand and put his arm around the waist of the pretty singer for the Lester Lannan Orchestra and done the dirty boogie, all the while waving the shiny knob of the stump where his right index finger used to be. Christ, that had just about finished off any social standing his son might have had, which hadn't been much to start with, other than the fact that he had been the fullback on the Georgia Tech football team at a time, more than 40 years ago, when Tech was a power in national football, a matter that seemed to cut more ice in Atlanta, Georgia, than Richmond, Virginia. Otherwise, he had been nothing but a big old boy from down below the Nat line, who was selling a lot of commercial real estate in Atlanta for Headlock and Company, and had a way with the girls. He certainly had had a way with Martha. She was a graduate of Sweetbriar College, who was in her first year of medical school at Emory University in Atlanta. And with scarcely a second thought, she gave up her plans to be a doctor, like her father, in order to be Mrs. Croker. For a time, there was no happier couple in the state of Georgia. He had to give himself credit for one thing. He had married well. But he was not a social climber. In point of fact, he had been far more captivated by Martha's sunny, flirtatious disposition and her fair white body than anything the Starlings of Virginia connection could possibly do for him. The connection did something for him all the same, when he went out on his own as a developer in the 1970s, inasmuch as Martha added a certain polish and tone to the enterprise. In the meantime, she had borne him 3 children. Martha, whom they called Mattie, Catherine, whom they called Caddy, and the youngest, Wallace, born when Martha was 37. Wallace. Wally. At this very moment, as he lay propped up on one elbow in bed with his new wife, feeling his pangs in the dark, Charlie was well aware that Wally was asleep in a bedroom in the other wing. Wally was 16 now. Charlie called him Wally. Nobody else did. To the rest of the world, he was Wallace. Charlie kept waiting for some robust, zestful spirit to break loose in the boy, so that people just couldn't resist calling him Wally. It hadn't yet. Wally was home for a week in some sort of independent project they had dreamed up at the boarding school in Massachusetts he went to, Trinian, and was staying with him for 3 days before he went back to his mother's. With another pang, he realized he didn't even know what kind of project Wally was supposed to be working on. He was grateful that Wally had elected to stay a few days with him, and yet in the past 2 days he had spent a grand total of about 30 minutes with his son, despite promising himself that this time they would do something significant together. This whole situation with Planner's Bank was eating up every spare moment he had. And besides that, if he was going to be honest with himself, he had to admit that something about Wally disturbed him. Wally always gave him a certain look, a certain lost, blank look. Charlie couldn't tell if it was a look of accusation, longing, or bewilderment. Wally had sufficient cause to be bewildered, of course. Mattie and Caddy had been grown and out on their own when all the turmoil over Serena had started 4 years ago, and he and Martha had separated. But Wally had been only 12. What was Wally supposed to think of Serena, who was younger than his sister Mattie? What was he supposed to think of his new 11-month-old half-sister, Kingsley, who was, at this moment, up in the third-floor nursery with this month's nanny, Heidi? A 50- or 60-year-old Filipino named Heidi. Kingsley was some name, too. Charlie had argued with Serena about it, but she was determined to add a little yuppie grandeur to the premises. Miss Kingsley Croker. Serena and Kingsley and Heidi and Wally, and up on the third floor of the other wing was the Wu dynasty. His cook, Nina Wu, and her sister, Jarmaine, the housekeeper, and Jarmaine's son, Lin Chi. Jesus Christ, what a menagerie! All these people to look after, support, pay for. All of them sleeping like tops, no doubt. While he has to wake up in the middle of the night with insomnia and go to the mat with phantom gains and a lot of other horrible nonsense. The house was deathly quiet. All he could hear was a muffled flow of air from the central air conditioning vents. Outside, it was one of those merciless, muggy nights in Georgia. What a racket the cicadas used to make at night in the summer when he was growing up. In those days, you just used to listen to the bugs and sweat it out. Serena was so young, she probably couldn't even imagine human life without air conditioning. He stared at her haunches again. She gave a little sigh from beneath a deep layer of sleep and moved one of her arms, but that was it. He became aware of an overwhelming urge to urinate. Gingerly, he pulled the covers back. Slowly, he swung his legs off the bed. Ever so stealthily, he stood up and began stealing across the carpet. A Wilton weave, or whatever Ronald called it, which had set him back $225 a yard. And bango! Stumped his toe on that spindly piece of whatever century wooden junk of a chair that Serena had placed by the door to the bathroom, and his knee started aching. Why the hell did he have to creep around in the dark like a goddamned mouse in his own goddamned house so that a 28-year-old woman, worn out from shopping and driving her Jaguar XJ6, could have her precious rest? Nevertheless, Creepy Mouse limped into the bathroom and shut the door without letting the latch so much as click in its slot. He switched on the light, and was practically annihilated by Ronald Vine's overkill of wall sconces, downlighters, beveled mirrors, and glistening marble surfaces. It was blinding. He felt so damn tired. The day was already wrecked. He stared at a big, bleary, bald-headed 60-year-old man in the mirror. He turned on the cold water at one of the basins and cupped his hands and rubbed water over his face. The water really made him want to urinate, and so he went over to the toilet, which was some streamlined, low-slung beige thing, and he urinated. Was this a bad sign, this urge he always had to urinate in the middle of the night? Was it the prostate or some other old man's problem? He would read a little. That was what he would do. It would be better than a pill. He wasn't the world's greatest reader, and trying to read before he went to bed at night usually put him right under. He noticed his half-glasses, another barnacle of advancing age, sticking out of the breast pocket of his bathrobe, which was hanging on the door. And so he put on the bathrobe and went out the far side of the bathroom and into his dressing room, and turned on the light in there. It was a big room, lined with closets and built-in bureaus and mirrors and bookshelves. A regular extravaganza of mahogany and OG'd moldings and beveled glass. He went over to the bookshelves and took down a book he'd been meaning to read anyway, The Paper Millionaire, by some Arab-turned-Englishman named Roger Shashua. He sat down in the lounge chair and put on the glasses and turned on the little brass reading lamp, which had cost a truly unbelievable amount. Ronald had ordered it from Nebraska, and opened the book. His eye fell on the inside jacket flap. In the course of his astonishing career, Roger Shashua made it, lost it, made it, lost it, made it yet again, and then, with impeccable timing, walked away from it all. Charlie closed the book, turned it over, and looked at the photograph of this Roger Shashua on the back. Cocky-looking little devil. An Arab, but with a typical Brit, half a smirk on his face. Ferocious head of hair, turning gray, but with every hair he ever had in his head still nailed in. All of 46 or 47 years old. Then he turned back through the jacket flap again. Made it. Lost it. Made it. Lost it, made it yet again. He lowered the book and stared at the mahogany closets without really seeing them. He had always thought of himself that way. He was a player. He wasn't greedy. He wasn't acquisitive. He was a player, a plunger, a risk-taker who loved the great game more than the rewards. If he lost everything, hell, what would it matter? He was a good old Baker County, Georgia boy who started off down in the dirt. And so the idea of rolling over in the dirt once more didn't scare him. He'd dust himself off and make it yet again. Hadn't he done that after the real estate debacle of the 1970s? Yeah, but he hadn't had all that much to lose in the first place back then, had he? And he had been only 30 years old. Chronological age didn't really mean anything, but... Jesus, he was 60 now. The thought weighed down his very bones. He tried to conceive of picking himself up from out of the dirt again. Flat broke, but indomitable. Indomitable! The notion of having to get up every day and show a flat broke but indomitable face to the world sent him sinking so deeply into the lounge chair, he wondered if he could even stand up. He gave in. He began to feel immensely sorry for himself. The hell with that! He sprang up out of the chair, as if escaping from the deadly caresses of self-pity. That played hell with his knee, and the sudden exertion made him light-headed. He caught a glimpse of himself in the mirror. He was in a crouch, clad in a nightshirt and a bathrobe with a pair of half-glasses teetering on the tip of his nose. He stuffed the glasses back into his pocket and put his hands on his knees and bent over and lowered his head in order to get some blood to his brain. And then he stood upright and made a fierce face in the mirror. Charlie Croker, brute! Charlie Croker, force of nature! The hell with 60 years old and whatever that was supposed to mean. Enough sitting here stewing. Action was called for. Go riding, that was it. He'd go out to the spread. The spread, as he had taken to calling it, was 40 acres off Crest Valley Road, not far from the Chattahoochee River National Park. It was like the Chattahoochee County countryside out there, and yet it was part of Atlanta, part of Buckhead, for that matter, loosely defined. He kept 3 horses at the spread, one of them being Jugsy, the big jumper he had just vanned up from Turpentine. Hell, he really ought to ride Jugsy every day. It was too early just yet. Dodson, the caretaker, and his wife, Fanny, who lived in the little house near the stable. Their dogs would start barking if they heard the stable opening up when it wasn't even light yet. Well, what he'd do was, he'd get dressed and go downstairs and fix himself breakfast. A big country breakfast. Eggs, grits, biscuits, smoked ham. A trout. He'd always loved it when his daddy cooked himself a trout for breakfast. That sharp, almost sweet, grilled smell came back to him as he stood in this frou-frou dressing room in the most expensive part of Buckhead. Except that there wouldn't be any trout in this establishment. But it would be a pleasure just to fix breakfast all by himself. Nina Wu wasn't a bad cook, but this morning he didn't need the presence of the Wu dynasty fluttering about him in all their insincere solicitude. No, he'd fix a big breakfast all by himself, and eat it at his leisure, and drink some good New Orleans coffee with chicory, and clear his head, and recharge the batteries, and go for a ride. He went over to one of the mahogany closets, his sports closet, Ronald called it, and took out his riding clothes, the high black boots, the tan pants, the polo shirt, a tweed hacking jacket, and the rest of it, and got dressed. The boots, so goddamned hard to put on. Custom-made. Fit like a corset around the calves. hurt his knee so much he groaned as he tugged on the handles of his metal boot pulls. He stood up. Ah, but what a fabulous figure he cut now. The boots were a dream in creamy black leather with glossy highlights. He could forgive the Wu dynasty a lot for the mule's work they always did on the boots. The riding pants were made of an elasticized twill that brought out the powerful curve of his thigh muscles, and the polo shirt showed off the massive hillocks of his chest and the prodigious girth of his upper arms. More than satisfied with himself, he hooked his jacket over his thumb and tossed it over his shoulder, threw his head back, struck a jaunty pose in the mirror, and went out into the hallway. He snapped on the staircase lights and headed down toward the kitchen. The scrambled eggs, well done, the steaming grits, with a little butter, the hot biscuits, made from scratch by Auntie Bella down at Turpentine and frozen and flown up here on the G5, the ever-so-thin slices of smoked country ham, slaughtered, cured, and aged by Uncle Bud down at Turpentine, the New Orleans coffee with chicory. Every nerve in his body was primed for the ambrosial aromas soon to come. The stair hall was a real piece of work, a symphony of big-bellied curves, with a balcony that swooped this way and a staircase that swooped down that way, and a walnut banister that swooped all over the place upon balusters of delicate and highly ornate ironwork. Charlie noticed none of that, however. Only one thing was on his mind, a real country breakfast, starring Charlie Croker, a Baker County boy who knew what life boiled down to, once all the fat was rendered away. Now he was at the final flamboyant curve of the staircase, where it headed down to the marble floor of the entry foyer, when, brang, 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 holy shit, all hell broke loose. Brang, 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 the sound hammered his head in relentless waves. Brang, 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 brang. The burglar alarm, he'd totally forgotten about it. Forgot to push the bypass switch, the motion detectors. On the ground floor, which was full of French doors, Serena didn't want sensors sitting there on every pane and had insisted on motion detectors. And anything that moved could set them off. He'd set off the alarm by walking down the stairs. Brang, 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 brang. There were alarm gongs all up and down the staircase, and outside the house, too. They were hammering their metal heads off. The noise was enough to cave your skull in. God damn you, Serena! Like any man who has just committed a blunder of elementary stupidity, Charlie racked his brain to find the malefactor who had made him do it. It was Serena who had insisted on this totally useless burglar alarm system. Charlie Croker was from Baker County, where you defend your own goddamn house, your own goddamn self. You don't wire yourself into some goddamn company manned by a bunch of half-wits who aren't much above burglars themselves. He had his bare hands and a short-barreled 20-gauge shotgun in the closet in the bedroom. He didn't need some armed, minimum-wage winos from Radartronic Security. Radartronic Security? Poking around his house in the middle of the night. Brang, 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 brang. The whole menagerie, Serena, Heidi Filipino, Miss Kingsley Croker, Wally, the Wu Dynasty, they'd all be ricocheting off the walls and descending upon him. Shut off the gongs. That was the main thing. The control box was in a closet in the bedroom. He went charging up the stairs in his riding boots. Clomp, 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 clomp. Knee hurt like hell. No time to worry about that. As he reached the second floor, he heard a clicking sound. That would be the telephone automatically dialing Radartronic Security, which was located somewhere down around the old Southern Railway yards. They, in turn, would telephone the house, and unless you answered and gave them your code number, they would call the police and dispatch their own so-called agents, who had keys to your house. Serena, that's so stupid, letting a bunch of jack-legged, barely employable bums have the keys to your home. What's the matter with you? On he charged. In no time, breathing stertorously, he was at the bedroom door. He turned the handle. Damn, it was locked. What idiot locked it? Who else? Serena. Now he could hear the telephone ringing. Trill, trill, trill. That would be the burglar alarm company calling back. Naturally, nobody in the whole menagerie answered it. He ran to the door of the dressing room. Thank God it opened. He dashed for the bathroom, went in, and opened the door to the bedroom. Brang, 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 brang. Trill, trill, trill. Pitch black in the bedroom, just the way he'd left it. He felt around on the wall for the light switch. The wall was lined with a padded fabric. It was like feeling around for a light switch in a mattress. Finally, he found it and switched it on. The bedroom rose up in the glow from tawny, peachy, pink-lined little silk lampshades atop wall sconces. The carved Victorian mantelpiece with its bevels and escutcheons, the billowing yards of chintz curtains and silk undercurtains, the fretwork radiator covers, the vast bed with its bombastic upholstered headboard. All of it popped out in a luxurious play of highlights and deep shadows. But no Serena. Not a trace of her. Serena, where are you? From behind the bed rose a tousled head of long black hair. A pair of extraordinary periwinkle blue eyes blazed away. Then the shoulders, bare except for a pair of salmon-pink straps that held up a little salmon-pink chemise, so low-cut that he could see all but the very tips of her breasts as she came out of her crouch. Young, fabulous, perfect breasts they were. It was a sight that had stirred Charlie Croker, brute, many times. But now he was possessed by another passion entirely, the urge to blame. "Jesus, Serena, answer the phone! What's that damn code number?" Then he took in the look on her young face. Her eyes were wide open and her lips were slightly parted. But it was not an expression of pure fear. There seemed to be a delicate balance between fear and panic on the one hand, and disbelief and hostility on the other. She put her hand to her sternum, as if to steady her heart.
"Charlie! What on earth?"
"Your goddamn motion detector, Serena! I was going downstairs to the kitchen. And I mean, shit, can't you pick up the telephone, for Christ's sake? That's the alarm company. What's that code number?" "Brang, brang, brang. Trill, trill, trill." Then it dawned on him that the telephone was, in fact, on the table on the other side of the bed. He pointed toward the closet where the control box was. "I'll get the telephone. See if you can't turn that goddamn thing off." She gave him a look. The balance was slipping rapidly toward disbelief and hostility. But she said nothing. As she went into the closet, he could see the cups of her buttocks where they showed beneath the little salmon-pink chemise. Brang, brang, brang.
Trill, trill, trill.
With a bound, Charlie reached the bedside table and picked up the telephone. Belligerently, "Hello!"
"This is surveillance. We have an alarm signal." It was a man's measured, carefully modulated, almost sing-song voice. It struck Charlie as a parody of someone trying to instill calm during an emergency. It infuriated him.
"It's a false alarm," said Charlie.
He made it sound like an accusation.
"Everything's okay."
The man's voice said, "Your name, please?" The way the voice went up, two or three notes on the please, irritated Charlie enormously. Besides, he wasn't used to having to tell people his name. By the time you spoke to Charlie Croker, you were supposed to know who he was. But he reined himself in.
"Charles Croker," he said in an even voice. But it was run over by the relentless brang, brang, brang.
"Say again, please," said the voice of Radartronic Security.
"I said Charles Croker. Can't you hear, for God's sake?"
The studiously imperturbable voice merely said, "Your ID number, please."
"What?"
"Your ID number, please."
"It's, 228, oh, for Christ's sake."
He looked toward the closet, toward Serena. The closet was full of clothes, and the control box was on a side wall, so that Serena had to lean in to get at it. Charlie could see her firm young legs bear right up to her perfect little bottom. There had been many times when this sight, too, had driven him wild. But now he saw a half-nude nitwit.
Brang, brang, brang. "Serena, what's that number? And for Christ's sake, can't you turn those damn gongs off? It's a little toggle switch."
In fact, as Charlie realized from the last time he'd set off the alarm by mistake, when you opened the control box, you were presented with a baffling profusion of fuses, colored wires, buttons, switches, a veritable electronic goulash. He was in no mood to be reasonable, however.
"Serena!"
The gongs hammered on, but Serena's head emerged from the closet. She didn't say anything at first. She looked him up and down, from his bald pate and angry face, down to the toes of his boots and back up again, before saying,
"It's taped to the bottom of the telephone."
Charlie picked up the telephone cradle and turned it over and then spoke into the receiver.
"Okay, are you listening?"
The voice said,
"Yes, we are."
Up to infuriating patient notes on the R.
"Okay, it's 22868.
"Thank you. Have you ascertained the origin of the signal?"
"Ascertain the origin?"
He found the wording ludicrously pretentious, but all he said was,
"Yes, it was a false alarm."
"Would you like the assistance of our agents?"
"Agents? Spare me. No, I don't need any of your agents."
The voice bade him goodbye with the same stenciled calm with which it had begun.
"Brang, brang!"
Suddenly the dreadful hammering noise stopped. Serena had finally found the switch. An after-ring filled Charlie's skull as he turned back toward the closet. Serena emerged, popping out of her little chemise. She was breathing hard and looking holes through him.
"I'm going to call upstairs to Heidi," she said.
She was breathing so rapidly it made her voice tremulous. She had sat down on the edge of the bed and picked up the telephone receiver and pressed an intercom button. Just then, a banging on the bedroom door.
"Dad! Dad, you in there?"
Charlie walked over, unlocked the door, and opened it about a foot. There was Wally, looking confused, sleepy, wilted, thin, gawky. He had a plaid bathrobe pulled over the T-shirt and boxer shorts he slept in. Wally was already 6 feet tall, and he had his father's curly blonde hair, or the same sort of hair Charlie had enjoyed when he was young, and the beginning of his handsome features. But he was not Charlie Croker, or close to becoming Charlie Croker. That was what crossed Charlie's mind the first time he saw him on any given day.
"What happened?"
asked Wally.
"Nothing to worry about," said Charlie. "Just Serena's... just the burglar alarm system having another one of its little fits."
"The burglar alarm system had a little fit?"
It was Serena. Charlie turned away from the door and looked at her. She was still sitting on the edge of the bed. She had her head cocked and a dubious little smile on her lips in the expression that asks,
"Is anybody actually supposed to believe what you just said?"
Wally stuck his head through the door. What he saw was his father's new wife sitting on the edge of his father's big bed with her long, bare legs crossed. Her hair tumbled down wildly over her bare shoulders. She had her arms crossed over her bosom, modestly enough, but there was no way that this girl and her young body could be modest in that tiny chemise. Wally's eyes stuck out like the hat pegs in a Baker County country church.
Charlie was mortified, and for reasons that went well beyond modesty. His 16-year-old son was getting a look, a forbidden look, in the very lair of the lust, the master bedroom, on the edge of the master's bed itself, at what his father had left his mother for. Charlie looked at Wally. Charlie looked at Serena. He wanted to say, "Wally, don't look! Get out of here!" He wanted to say, "Serena, for God's sake, vanish! Cover yourself!" But he couldn't get a word out. As if reading his mind, Serena stood up and said, "Excuse me," and walked over to the closet and took the matching salmon-pink silk bathrobe off a door hook and slipped into it and wrapped it about her and tied the sash. It took no more than 15 seconds, but in those 15 seconds, Wally, 16 years of age, drank in a lifetime supply of lubricious crevices and undulating lamb chops and those and them and these and that. And Croker had never even had that talk with Wally, the most important talk a father could have with a son. Not the one about the birds and the bees, but the one about how things really are, actually are, in real life, between men and women. At last Wally averted his eyes and asked his father, "Are the police coming?" "No," said Charlie, "the police aren't coming, and neither's those scarecrows from the burglar alarm company. I'd rather have a burglar in the house than one of those homeless with pistols they send over here." Now Wally was looking at him with his blank, bewildered expression. He was looking him up and down from the top of his head to the toes of his spiffy boots, the same way Serena had the moment before.
"What are you wearing, Dad?"
Since it was perfectly obvious what he was wearing, Charlie found the question impertinent. At the same time, he didn't want to be antagonistic to Wally, whom he so seldom saw, and so he put on the beginning of a smile and said, "Well, what's it look like?"
"You're going riding? Now?"
"I sure am, if I can ever get out of here. Out at the spread. I brought Jugsy up from Turpentine. You remember Jugsy, don't you, the big bay jumper?"
Wally nodded yes with blank, unbelieving eyes, as if humoring a lunatic. Charlie detected some of that and said,
"It's a great time to go riding. The dawn comes up. Nobody ever gets to see a real dawn in Atlanta anymore. You ought to come with me, Wally. You can ride Bird. You rode her once, didn't you?"
For half a second he figured it just might work out. It could be the significant experience he had been promising himself. Father and son riding side by side over the rolling hills of the spread at dawn, as the sun rises up behind the distant towers of the city. It would be something Wally would never forget. This burglar alarm fiasco might turn out to be all for the best. And then he saw the look on Wally's face. The boy was smiling gamely, and his head was nodding yes, and his eyes, which were as big around and blank as a pair of clay pigeons, were saying, "Not in a million years." It was what was known in the coarse argot of real estate development as a grin fuck. Serena walked toward them. Wrapped in her robe of the finest charmeuse, she looked gorgeous. Her black hair was full and rich and bouncy. Her skin was fair. Her neck was long, bare, and lovely.
"Charlie," she said, speaking all too calmly now, "did I hear you say riding? Do you have any idea whatsoever what time it is?"
Then she extended an uplifted palm toward the clock on the bedside table. It was the patronizing gesture that says,
"Please be my guest."
Against his better instincts, he looked at it.
Damn!
3:55 a.m. Desperately he wished for the psychokinetic power to make it blip forward 6 minutes, so that it would at least be after 4 o'clock. Her arm still extended, Serena demanded,
"What time does it say?"
It was the tone you would use on a child. Now it was Charlie who was bewildered. The impudence! A 28-year-old girl standing here and next to nothing, trying to make him look like a doddering idiot in front of his son. Frantically, he ransacked his brain for the proper strategy. He couldn't just let her have it, tell her to mind her goddamn mouth, not in front of Wally. He couldn't just laugh it off. He'd look weak, since she was clearly trying to put him in his place. No, he'd tell her about the country breakfast. The country breakfast! How he was going to fix himself a real country breakfast with all the trimmings. How he was going to relax and enjoy it. How it would take more than an hour, and then it would be after 5, which would be a good time to head out to... Ah, hell. That would really sound like a confused old man. A man with 3 servants in the house, who's getting ready to go down to the kitchen by himself to fix a real country breakfast on one of the most expensive streets in Buckhead at 3:55 in the morning. And besides, every true leader of men knew that when challenged by an underling, you don't stop to explain. You squash that underling and explain later, if you have to. But suppose the underling is your barely clad new wife, and your 16-year-old son by your old wife is standing there. What do you do then? Around and around his brain whirled, and he was aware that his lips were parted and no words were coming out. Loud whispering and giggling out in the hallway. He knew who that would be. The Wu Dynasty. Grateful for an interruption, he held up his forefinger and said, "Just a second," and ducked out into the hall, pulling the bedroom door almost shut. Sure enough, there were Jermaine and Nina, a pair of plump, 40-ish-looking figures in bathrobes. He had never seen them in such a state before. Their thick black hair was sticking out every which way, like a pair of dove's nests. Their legs were bare and not terrific to look at, being stumpy and slightly bowed. A few feet behind them, hanging onto the stair hall banister, for the fun of it, was Lin Chi, who was 8. He was in a T-shirt and little undershorts. Jermaine and Nina were smiling mightily.
"Mr. Crocker," said Nina through her big smile. "Burglar alarm go off."
Both women looked at Charlie and giggled. Charlie did not find this at all unusual, however. They never laughed in his presence, out of amusement. It was always out of embarrassment. In this case, probably over the fact that they had had the temerity to venture so close to the master bedroom in the middle of the night. Croker explained what had happened, providing a version of the facts that would make it easy to conclude that the system had malfunctioned.
"Oh," said Nina, changing to a serious expression. The "oh" came out as a wail of revelation.
Meantime, Lin Chi, the 8-year-old, gripped a baluster with both hands and let his body hang sideways, like a sailor clutching a railing in the wind, all the while staring fixedly at Charlie. Charlie had come to like Lin Chi. He was a real boy. In a few years, he'd be a handful. He was more like what he wanted to see in a son than Wally was. He smiled at Lin Chi.
"Makes a lot of noise, don't it, Lin Chi, that burglar alarm?"
"You can say that again,"
said Lin Chi, still hanging sideways. He had no accent at all. Terribly embarrassed, Jermaine and Nina reddened, giggled, glared at Lin Chi, and then beamed at Charlie and giggled some more. Charlie laughed heartily to show them he hadn't found Lin Chi impertinent, and then he said,
"Well, you ain't got to worry about it any more, Lin Chi. We're getting rid of it. It ain't good for nothing but false alarms, is it?"
Unconsciously, the ain'ts were a great Charlie Croker compliment. They meant, "You're a real boy. You're my kind." What the hell had happened to all these sons of the rich in Wally's generation? these well-brought-up boys who went off to the private schools. These damn schools were producing a new kind of scion of the elite. A boy utterly world-weary by the age of 16. Cynical, phlegmatic, and apathetic around adults. Although perfectly respectful and maddeningly polite. A boy inept at sports. Averse to hunting and fishing and riding horses or handling animals in any way. A boy embarrassed by his advantages. Desperate to hide them. Eager to dress in backward baseball caps and homey pants and other ghetto rags. Terrified of being envied. A boy facing the world without any visible signs of the joy of living and without balls. Now down the stairs came another figure, walking past the Wu dynasty. A small, thin woman in a white uniform she'd obviously just jumped into. She had made a stab at pushing her black hair back from her face, but it was almost as big a mess as Jarmaine's and Nina's. She was barefoot. She was carrying a little bundled armful. It was Heidi, the Filipino nanny, carrying Miss Kingsley Croker. The bare feet were not the result of haste, however. Heidi was the most proper nanny they had had in the house in 11 months of hiring and firing nannies. But she always went about in bare feet. That detail Charlie always noticed. It reminded him of a book he'd seen once in the library at Tech. It was a picture book of the kilts and full regalia of the Scottish clans. It was full of lovingly colorful illustrations of Scottish lairds dressed up to beat the band, all of them with bare legs, big knotty calves, and bare feet. It was as if there was something down home, hog-stomping and primeval in their makeup that you couldn't remove, no matter how fancy the clothes became. Charlie loved that, since he always assumed he was the same way. Whether this was a desirable attribute in a nanny or not, he couldn't decide. As she rounded the last bend in the flight of stairs, Heidi looked at him and said brightly,
"Hello, mister. Everything okay?"
"Yep," said Charlie. "Everything's okay. Just a false alarm. She gets scared." He motioned toward Kingsley, a pale little creature curled up in the nanny's arms, apparently dead to the world. She. He disliked the name Kingsley so much he avoided using it.
"Oh, no, mister. She don't wake up."
The little girl's eyes were shut tight. She tucked her head and buried it in Heidi's bosom. Jarmaine and Nina made a polite fuss over the heiress apparent and turned back toward Charlie and did some more giggling. Their eyes were trained on his face, but then they lowered and drifted down, down over his polo shirt and his tight twill riding pants and his boots with all the glossy highlights, and then back up to the riding pants and the polo shirt, and up to his face. Lin Chi was doing the same thing, except that his eyes remained fixed on the fabulous boots. Heidi's, too. She took in all of him, but the boots were what really got her. All of them, save the infant, had been blasted out of their REM sleep by a burglar alarm, and blown into the hallway to find Cap'n Charlie dressed up in his high black boots as if he's about to hop on a horse at 3:55 a.m. "I can explain," but he fought off the urge. Real leaders didn't explain. Now he was aware of voices behind him, inside the bedroom. Low voices, confidential voices. And not just voices either, but also chuckles. Wally. Serena. He couldn't believe it. They sounded like the merriest young pals you ever encountered. He couldn't believe it, and he didn't like it. They barely knew each other, and their relationship, such as it was, had always seemed awkward and strained. What could they possibly be chuckling over? What little joke were they sharing? Him. Charlie. It had to be at his expense. Just then the bedroom door opened and Wally emerged. His head and his eyes were downcast, thanks to poor posture and apathy, no doubt. But a smile was spread on his lips. The afterglow of his conversation with his father's wife in the next-to-nothing outfit. Then he looked up and saw his father standing there, and the smile vanished, and he clamped his blank look back on. Charlie was furious. But what could he say? So he swept his eyes over the whole menagerie, Wally included, and said, "All right, why don't you all go back to bed now? Get some sleep." He said it so sharply it was like a rebuke, an inexplicable rebuke. But that was all right. Every real leader knew that the occasional outburst of unexplained anger was good for discipline. It set the troops to searching their own conduct for flaws. They all started trudging back to their quarters. Wally, his head lowered, his shoulders stooped, lugged his 16 years off the most wearily of all. Charlie went into the bedroom to set a few things straight. He shut the door behind him. Serena was sitting on the edge of the bed again, facing him. She lowered her head, dug the fingers of both hands in under her hair at the scalp line, threw her tangled black mane back over her shoulder, raised her head, and looked him right in the eye. There was a hint of a smile on her face. Well, she was certainly in a good mood all of a sudden, after joking with Wally about his 60-year-old father. He glowered at her for a couple of beats, then gestured behind him toward the hallway. "You missed the town meeting." It wasn't uttered as a little witticism. It was sarcasm incised on a tablet brought down from on high by the patriarch, Blame. "Oh?" If anything, Serena's trace of a smile grew a bit bolder. "Yeah, they were all there. Your burglar alarm brought the whole gang. The whole Wu dynasty, including Lin Chi. He was hanging off the spindles. And Heidi Filipino, barefoot." All Serena did was change her suggestion of a smile into a suggestion of a sneer. So Charlie said, "Heidi brought your daughter down, in case you're interested. She was fine. She slept through the whole thing, if you were wondering."
"I know. I talked to Heidi on the intercom."
She didn't even sound defensive, which annoyed him still more. "Serena, you realize that's the third false alarm in the past month or so?"
"Past 6 months or so."
"Well, whatever. It's ridiculous. What earthly good is it? The police, they get so many false alarms they don't even bother to respond. And Radartronic Security. I hope you don't honestly believe Radartronic Security is actually going to protect anybody. Who do you think works for these companies? Who do you think you get for minimum wage or whatever they pay? You get drifters, winos. And then they let them carry sidearms. And they've got the keys to the house. It's ludicrous. We're saying goodbye to the burglar alarm system."
"Well, well, well. I hadn't noticed you were so well informed about burglar alarms and burglar alarm companies."
"The impudence. I'm informed enough, and even if I wasn't, I'm from Baker County, Georgia, and I can take care of my own house. If these ain't enough," he held up his hands, "I got a 20-gauge shotgun in the closet. If I have to shoot a man, I can do it. I've done it before."
"In Vietnam, you're talking about?"
As a matter of fact, he was. But was she really saying what he thought she was saying, which was,
"You've already bragged to me about what a holy terror you were in the war in Vietnam 30 years ago."
"I'm talking about how it's going to be in this house from now on. That's what I'm talking about. There ain't going to be any more burglar alarm. Is that clear enough?"
Serena put both palms down flat on the bed and stiffened her arms and leaned back and uncrossed her legs and let them fall open in a pose of insouciance. Her breasts welled up under the layers of salmon-pink charmeuse. He could see the insides of her thighs where the robe had parted. Her little half-smile, half-sneer, intensified.
She looked him right in the eye. She said, "Who's supposed to shoot the man when you're not here?"
"What are you talking about? What man?"
"You said if you have to shoot a man. Suppose you're out of town or off riding a horse at 3 o'clock in the morning. Who's supposed to shoot the man then? Me? Heidi? Nina? Jarmaine? They're not from Baker County, Georgia, far as I can tell. And I doubt if they've been to war, although we can always ask them."
"Now you listen, goddammit.
Don't you swear at me."
With a single angry thrust of her arms, she was up off the edge of the bed and walking toward the bathroom. Her little expression had vanished. She wasn't even looking at him any longer. She was turning her back on him and walking out of the room. He tried to grab her by the arm. With a furious wrench, she broke free and confronted him, her eyes ablaze.
"Now you listen, Charlie. You don't even know what's just happened in this house, do you? You don't understand the first thing."
"I know one thing that's happened, and I know one thing that's about to happen."
"Oh, kindly spare me the caveman stuff. Why don't you do yourself a favor and go in the bathroom?"
She extended her arm and pointed a finger toward the bathroom door like a parent ordering a child to march.
"Take a look at yourself in the mirror, in the full-length mirror. Just take a good look. Make sure you can see the boots, too."
And in that moment, what struck Charlie even more than the outright insolence was her face. It wasn't contorted. There was no furious scowl. Her chin wasn't trembling. She wasn't about to sob or shake or come to pieces in any fashion. Oh, no, not her. She was the very picture of icy superiority. A 28-year-old girl laying down a lecture to Charlie Croker himself. He didn't know what to say.
"You're so busy being the big stuff," she was saying. "You don't even want to think how it might affect anybody else in the house."
"Such as you, I suppose."
"Such as me, for a start. All of a sudden I wake up. The burglar alarm is ringing. I turn toward my husband, who's supposed to be beside me in bed, and he's not there. I look at the clock, and it's 3-something. I call out your name, you don't answer. I look in the bathroom. You're not in there either. For all I knew, somebody'd broken into the house, and you were lying in a pool of blood. Just then I hear this terrific racket. You never heard such a commotion. Sounds like somebody's charging up the stairs in army boots, some maniac or something. I turn over and lock the bedroom door, just in time, because the next thing I know, somebody's turning the handle of the door this way and that, trying to get in, and throwing his weight against the door, like he's going to push it in, and grunting and groaning. Doesn't even sound like a human being. Sounds like a bear or a monster. It's going, like that. So I hide behind the bed. When it breaks down the door, maybe it won't see me. Then I hear it coming through the bathroom. Then I hear it fumbling around on the wall for the light. I figure, this is it. It's coming after me. And then I hear this angry, belligerent voice say, "Serena!"
I was only trying to get to the control box to...
Let me finish.
Turn the thing off before...
Let me finish.
It woke the whole house up and...
Let me finish. Good. Thank you very much. Then the light comes on and it's standing there. It's got on riding boots right up to its knees. It's got on riding pants. It's got on a polo shirt. 3 o'clock in the morning and it's going riding.
3:55, said Charlie, immediately realizing how lame it sounded.
"Oh, 3:55. Excuse me. All right, 3:55. You set off the alarm, even though you know very well you have to turn it off before you go downstairs. And what's your first instinct? To blame somebody else. To blame me."
"I never blamed you."
"No. No. I wish you could have seen the look on your face. God damn this, and Jesus Christ that, and shit, look what you did, Serena, and get in that closet, and what the hell's the matter with you, Serena, when I couldn't find that little switch right away. You weren't blaming me? What would you call it?"
"The alarm was ringing, the phone was ringing, all hell was breaking loose. I was only trying to get things under control."
"You were only trying to shift the blame, was what you were only trying to do, Charlie.
I still haven't heard a single, "Gee, I'm sorry," or anything else.
I know what you told your son. I hate to think what you told Nina and Jarmaine and Heidi.
Charlie was angry all over again. All right. You finished now?
No, said his wife. I'm not. I really do think you ought to go in the bathroom right now and take a look at yourself. It's the middle of the night, Charlie, and you're up and dressed in this...
While she searched for the word, she waved her hand at him dismissively.
This get-up of yours. The barn isn't open in the middle of the night. Maybe Jugsy's only a stupid horse, but he's not so stupid that he's standing around ready to go in the middle of the night.
She jutted her chin forward slightly and cocked her head and gave him a look of mock solicitude.
What are you doing? Anybody who didn't know you would think you were gaga.
With that, she turned and headed straight into the bathroom and shut the door and locked it.
Gaga? The impudence!
Charlie was furious, and yet in that very moment he realized that it wasn't that good, keen, pure, all-out male fury that had served him so well over the years. He was going to make her feel 6 kinds of sorry when she came out of that bathroom. But, in fact, he felt so damned tired. His head felt like a husk. He walked over and sat down on the side of the bed. He closed his eyes and massaged his temples with his fingertips. Maybe the good old country breakfast would revive him. He'd haul out the pans and thaw the biscuits and the grits. Or were the grits frozen? And where were the pans, for that matter? And the butter and the coffee? It dawned on him that he didn't have a ghost of an idea where any of it was kept. Well, he'd figure it out. He pivoted on his hip and brought one leg up onto the bed, boot and all. The boot wasn't going to do much for the bed's white coverlet, which had a little waffle design on it and came from, what the hell was the name of it, some place where they sold sheets for $500 apiece was all he knew. Well, he was the one who had paid for all this stuff in the first place, and so he could put his damned boots any damned place he felt like. So he brought the other leg and the other boot up and let his upper body sink back on the bed and his head sink back on the pillow. He closed his eyes. He'd catch 40 winks and then go downstairs and get some breakfast and head on over to the spread, and the hell with what Serena or anybody else had to say about the middle of the night. He could hear her running the water in the bathroom. He hoped she'd keep it on for a while. It was a soothing sound, and as long as he could hear it, he wouldn't be having to deal with her unbelievable impudence.
Christ! Who was this woman?
How the hell did she get here? The questions startled him. Then he realized they had been forming in his mind for the past 30 months at least, and he had only been married to her for 36. But never before had they just popped into his head in so many words. Who was she? What was she doing here? And the terrible thing was, once he finally asked the questions, he knew the answers. Sex and vanity. It was as simple as that. And maybe vanity even more than sex. Martha had gotten older, that was all. And as he lay there, stretched out on the bed, a vision of Martha's shoulders and neck, just her shoulders and neck, floated into his head. That was what he had noticed, once she reached her 40s, he guessed it was. Martha had always been a big girl, a big, sunny, lovely girl. But as she got older, she got thicker. Her midsection got thicker, and her skin got thicker, and her shoulders and her upper back began to round over a little bit and get thicker. One night at a big tech reunion at the Hyatt Regency, she was wearing some kind of bare-shouldered dress, and he happened to come up behind her from a certain angle, and, Jesus Christ, she had shoulders like a middle linebacker for the Dallas Cowboys, his wife did. He couldn't get that image out of his mind. Like a middle linebacker.
And how often could you get aroused by a 40-some-year-old woman with that much beef in her neck and her shoulders and her upper back? He hated himself for even thinking it. But that was the way the male animal was constituted, wasn't it? Involuntarily he sighed, just lying here with his eyes closed. A wavelet of guilt washed over him. Martha's beefy shoulders lingered behind his eyelids for a moment. And then he could see Serena the way she had looked the first time he had ever laid eyes on her. She was standing in front of a meeting room at Planner's Bank, conducting some kind of art investment seminar the bank had cooked up. John Sycamore and Ray Peepgas had talked him into attending it. They had these young women from some kind of graduate school in New York conducting these goddamn things, these seminars, and Serena was standing up there giving a talk with slides and a laser light pointer she held in her hand. She had on a little black dress that made her seem more naked than if she had been wearing nothing at all. She was so sexy that if she had pointed that little laser thing at him and hit the button, he would have risen up right then and there and done something silly. The lecture was pure bullshit, something about some German artists named Kiefer and Baselitz and something or other, and how much their totally sick paintings would be worth in 5 years if you invested in them now. But the lecturer he had gone for all the way. At the time, it had seemed like nothing more than the usual thing. In Atlanta, a real estate developer was a star. And some of the others, like Lucky Putney, Dolph Brower, and his old buddy Billy Bass, were out tomcatting around so openly, so outrageously, that his little fling with Serena seemed like nothing at all. She made him feel like a kid, like a 20-year-old in the season of the rising sap. She liked it good and reckless, like that time they went off for a weekend to Myrtle Beach. Another wavelet of guilt. The terrible lies he dreamed up to tell Martha in order to arrange these things. And they were walking along the beach, and then they went over behind some sand dunes. And he couldn't believe it. She had a funny look on her face, and she took off her bikini. And he took off his swimming trunks, in the middle of a bright, sunny day, with a lighthouse or observatory or whatever it was not 300 yards away. They could have been caught at any moment. Him, the great star, 56 years old, rotting away in the sand, sex-crazed like a dog in the park. But that was the thing. At 55 or 56... you still think you're a young man. You still think your power and energy are boundless and eternal. You still think you're going to live forever. And, in fact, you're attached to your youth only by a thread, not a cord, not a cable. And that thread can snap at any moment. And it will snap soon in any case. And then where are you? Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, and I shall be paid. Nobody ever warned anybody about this, did they? All those experts, all those people who wrote the books and articles and ran the talk shows on television or whatever, when they talked about marriage, they were always talking about the first marriage, the original marriage. But by now, he figured, there must be thousands of men like him. Rich businessmen, who over the past 10 or 15 years had divorced their old wives of 2 to 3 decades standing, and taken on new wives, girls a whole generation younger. And what did all the experts have to say about these irresistible little morsels? Nothing. What if a man goes through all that, the separation, the divorce, all that agony, that struggle, that hellish expense, that guilt. And one day or one night he wakes up and wonders, who the hell is this in the bed next to me? Why is she here? Where did she come from? What does she want? Why won't she leave? That they don't tell you about. The thought made him tired. So tired. So tired. So tired. In the bathroom, the water continued to rush and rush. Charlie Croker lay stretched out on the bed, in his big, glossy, black riding boots, with all the lights on, surveying the world from behind his eyelids. In no time, in far fewer than 40 winks, he rode off into the land of Nod. Chapter 7 Hello out there, 7-Eleven land. It was the time of day Raymond Peepgas dreaded most. It was after 9 p.m. this warm April night, and dark outside, and he was alone in his mean little rental unit. Rental unit. $625 a month. Apartment number XXXA. XXX. At the bottom of the steep asphalt slope of the Normandy Lee Apartments at the base of the concrete-walled cliff that supported Highway 75, some 70 or 80 feet overhead. Terribly warm and muggy tonight, for late April in Atlanta. But if he kept the two little windows in the little living room open to get some air, he could hear the merciless hum of the 8 lanes of traffic up on the expressway, plus the gear changes and diesel horns of the trucks, and the crabby sounds of the young couples, already fed up with marriage, buckling and unbuckling their bawling children into and out of the streptofoam-lined plastic child safety seats in their Toyotas and Hondas out on the asphalt in front of the building. On the other hand, if he closed the windows, he had to turn on the incremental room air conditioner, which made a grinding noise whenever the compressor came on. So he kept the windows open, and now he could hear one of the young wives screaming at her husband. It was mostly the young wives who screamed. Sometimes the husband, but mostly the wife. He could hear one of the wives screaming,
"Oh, that's just great! How many times did I tell you? Your attitude toward your own child stinks! It just stinks the whole place up! Yuck!"
A child began howling. Stinks. That was the sort of thing young wives yelled at their husbands these days. Stinks. Normandy Lee. Lee. Peepgas had looked it up. A lee was a grassy meadow. Normandy Lee consisted of 3 2-story buildings parallel to one another, each containing 20 apartment units. For some eccentric reason, each unit bore a Roman numeral plus an Arabic letter from 1A and 1B to XXXA and XXXB. The Lee was a 3-foot-wide swath of grass that fringed each building. Normandy came in the form of 3 astonishing steeply pitched roofs made to look like the roofs of dairy barns in northern France. The fact that Peepgas had drawn an XXX unit, XXX, down at the bottom of the ravine, at the base of the highway cliff, this he found frighteningly but perfectly in keeping with his general run of fortune. Technically, the Normandy Lee was in Collier Hills, and technically Collier Hills was the southernmost part of Buckhead. Beyond that, there wasn't much you could say about this poor little apartment. Christ God, he was lonesome. The hums, thrums, and belches of Highway 75 only made it worse. All those people, hundreds of them, thousands of them, roaring past up there on top of the cliff, going somewhere, probably to see somebody. And he sat here alone at 9:15 p.m., looking out the window here in Unit XXXA into the window of Unit XIXA in the next building. Whoever lived there had tilted a mattress up against the wall and hung a bunch of plastic hangers with skirt clips on the edge of the mattress for some unfathomable reason. And he had thought Snellville was low-rent living. Jesus, the house in Snellville, a two-story, four-bedroom Williamsburg colonial with a mock Jack and Jill slate-roofed well in the front yard, coach lights by the front door, and an NBA products glass basketball basket on a stanchion out by the little back-around in front of the garage, despite the way he used to complain about the hour's drive down to Atlanta every morning in all that hellish traffic. The house in Snellville had been San Simeon compared to this. At least there were people there. Betty, heavy and overbearing as she was, at least she was someone to talk to. Brian and Aubrey, only 11 and 9, but fellow human beings all the same, little souls who at least filled up the void of the night. "Now you've done it. Sometimes you really make me want to puke. You really do." The husband this time. Peep Gas went to the window to get closer to humanity, if only as a voyeur. The husband had parked one baby, strapped into its child seat, up on top of the roof of the Toyota, and the child was yowling. The husband was wearing a white T-shirt and a shaggy, shapeless, much-too-big sleeveless sweater and jeans, plus a baseball cap. The wife wore jeans, hideously gaudy sneakers, and a black-and-red plaid lager shirt with the tail hanging out. She was holding the other baby, which was also yowling, in another child safety seat with a lot of veal-colored straps hanging down. Peep Gas waited for more dialogue.